You're listening to the Inside the Mix podcast with your host, Mark Matthews.
Hello and welcome to the Inside the Mix podcast. I'm Mark Matthews, your host, musician, producer, and mix and mastering engineer. You've come to the right place if you want to know more about your favorite synth music artists, music engineering and production, songwriting, and the music industry. I've been writing, producing, mixing, and mastering music for over 15 years, and I want to share what I've learned with you. Hey folks, and welcome back to the Inside the Mix podcast. And in this episode, I'm very excited to welcome our guest today, Herman Maximus. He is a Belgian producer with a focus on instrumental synthesizer atmosphere and sound aesthetics that evoke a true dreamwave experience. He's going to share with us his story behind the Future Kids sophomore release, 80s Dreams, out now via Outland Records. Do check that out. I highly recommend. Hi Herman, thanks for joining me today. And how are you?
Hi. I'm good. How are you?
Yeah, I've spent the in the UK we have things called car boot sales, which is basically where a load of people get together in a field and sell stuff out the back of their cars. So I spent the morning doing that, looking for vinyl, which was interesting. Do you have those sorts of things where you are?
Not really. I don't know. I don't think so. to be honest, I haven't. No, I haven't seen any vinyls in 20 years, probably. So, no.
Oh, wow, man. So, it's quite a UK, maybe it's a UK-centric thing then, where we spend our weekends going through other people's junk, trying to find vinyl at the back of their cars. So for the audience listening, Herman was actually interviewed on episode 7 of the podcast, where we discussed various things. So like we discussed the three pillars of hip hop, and it's linked to synthwave and why synthwave will never die, which feedback from that episode, a lot of people have mentioned that and found that really interesting. And the release of your debut album, Lost Summer, which was a fantastic release. So if you want to learn more about Herman's actual background and that release, do go back after this episode and check out episode 7. So Herman, what I want to sort of start off with is sort of chapter 1, as it were, is taking Future Kids to the stage. So I saw on your Instagram that you're going to be appearing at the ONA Electronica Synthwave Fest in September in Barcelona. How did you come across that opportunity? Were you approached? Did you approach the organizers?
Well, as you know, The Last Concord is also on Outland Recordings, we were sort of the two discovery artists that were introduced by Outland almost together instantaneously. So I think we were 2 weeks apart or something, and we kind of made a connection from there. And because they are organizing the ONA Electronica Synthwave Fest, I think it's just maybe natural that they asked me as well.
Amazing. There's some fantastic artists performing on that. So obviously you mentioned the last called Concord. Great guys. So I had them on the podcast. I think it was a couple episodes after yourself. And their releases are awesome, man. So you're going to be sharing the stage with the last called Concord and sort of Marvel 83. Is there any artist in particular that you're going to be playing with that you're sort of most excited to share the stage with?
Yeah, I think all of them really, but one I think specifically, I think Marvel 83. He was a huge influence for my first album. I think, you know, I'm always listening to Time Cop and Marvel, but I really think he had probably the most influence on my earlier sound. And yeah, of course, I'm really excited to see him and see him, see how he brings his music to life on stage.
Yeah, I can imagine, man. It's going to be great, like performing and then being able to watch those artists sort of once you're done and dusted. I'm envious, and also in what will essentially be the Barcelona sun as well. So very envious of you there. So my next question is, you mentioned there about the artist taking the taking their music to the stage. So can you tell our audience a bit about how you envisage sort of like what you plan to do to take the Future Kids to the stage and what that might look like and what challenges you think there might be?
Yeah, I think I had two options in my mind. One was a sort of a, more like a musical performance, more like a stage band with various team members. But of course, you have the practical problems. You need to have more than one band member, of course. And yeah, it needs to be in sync, which is for electronic music, like not really an easy thing to do. I did some experiments with an electronic drum kit, but I think it's just too hard to bring that to a stage in a premature like for your first performances. So after that, I was exploring more like an EDM kind of approach. Not really I wouldn't say a DJ set, but something that was more electronically orientated. So more more like I think you could compare it to Daft Punk a little. You know how they approach their live sets, like it's pre-organized, but still you have some room for experiments. So I'm rearranging all my songs into one live set, and I'm adding different elements to it. I'm changing the structure, so you know it's not like I'm just playing my songs from the album. So I'm reworking them. I'm adding new layers. I'm making sure I can tweak things live on stage. So that's basically where I'm at the moment.
Amazing. Yeah, I was going to say it would be. I think that's the way to go, isn't it? Is not to just play your album, because you could just stick on a CD essentially, couldn't you? Or a CD, or you could stream it. So to make those changes. Have you performed before under the Future Kids, or at all? Have you got a history of performance?
Yeah, actually I do, because I think I mentioned this before. I was a saxophone player, and I played in a funeral band, so I've got some experience there. Also, I did some live shows. I hope it's not like a funeral this time, but I don't think so.
No, I'm sure it won't.
I actually, when I did music 20 years ago, I made like a demo album, and I did some live performances like that. I played with a guitar on stage. So I put a helmet on, but I was suffocating, because in that time people could still smoke in the venue. So I was kind of suffocating in my helmet. I didn't really calculate that in. So yeah, I do have some experience and things that can go wrong. So always make sure you have a backup. So yeah, I think I'm ready. Yeah, I'm older now, so.
I remember you saying about the saxophone now. That twigs my memory. But yeah, the guitar with the helmet's great, man.
I couldn't see my keys.
I think the smoking ban came in before I started performing over here in the UK, so I never had that pleasure of performing in a room full of smoke. Although you got like smoke machines, but I suppose it's a bit different. No, that's cool, man. No, I'm going to keep an eye out for that, and I'll plug the festival as well, because I think it's going to be great. Do you know if they're going to be doing any live streams of it? I suppose that's down to the organizer, isn't it? It'd be great to be able to, if you could see it online for those who can't get to Barcelona.
Yeah, I think that's a. I also have some fresh ideas, and that's also a really good idea. Yeah, I think. I think that's a good idea for people who don't have the opportunity to come and see, because you know a lot of listeners are outside of Europe, and even if you're inside of Europe, you know it's still it can still be a long trip to do. But you know, I also think it's maybe it's the only time I'll do a live performance, and well, you never know.
Yeah, I think. as the countries open up now, it's Barcelona is certainly a place I want to visit. Been to Madrid, but not Barcelona. So what I'd like to move on to next, Herman, is the story sort of behind the album that you've recently released, so 80s Dreams. So can you tell our audience a bit about the story behind the album and what they can expect? Does it follow on from Lost Summer?
Yeah, I think it does, because initially I was writing new songs and I wanted to stay in sort of the same atmosphere, but at the same time, you know, it's not easy to it's not really easy to make the same sort of songs over and over again, you know, and even if you could, I don't think it's a very good idea to do. At the same time, I remember when I had my favorite bands, I didn't really like them to change their sound like a lot. So I try to stay in the same atmosphere, but at the same time change it a little to evolve. And I think I managed to do that. As for the inspiration, I think to me it was clear from the start, like I wanted to do something like extremely nostalgic, if you can say that, even more than the first album. So I wanted to tap into that. And when I was making the demos, at one point I put one of the demos onto a montage of 80s videos, video fragments. And from there it just clicked, and I kept writing, and it all sort of glued together. So I was really happy to have found a concept that worked for me.
So you mentioned there about making the songs, making sure they sound different. So did you have an idea in mind of how you were going to start out that process? Because like you say, you didn't want to sort of carry on and follow, because you could just make Lost Summer again, essentially. But I mean, what was your first step to make sure it sounded different?
We'll be right back.
Are you facing a common hurdle in your music journey? If mastering feels like an enigma, trust me, you're not alone. Whether you're an independent artist or a music producer, the struggle with unbalanced masters that just won't translate across various devices and environments is all too familiar. Ever found yourself puzzled, wondering, why don't my masters match my references? Perhaps you've delved into countless hours attempting the DIY route, only to find the end results unsatisfactory. Maybe you've experimented with numerous silver bullet plugins or even AI solutions, but the desired outcome still eludes you. Or maybe you're currently collaborating with an engineer and yearn for something fresh and different. That's precisely where I step in. At Synth Music Mastering, I'm offering a special opportunity, a one-time free test master available for a limited time. Picture elevating your music with my unwavering dedication to quality and a welcoming, personalized approach that you just don't get with a big mastering studio. What's even better? It's entirely free. All you need to do is submit a finished mix. It's a no-brainer, right? So seize the chance now to get your free test master. Simply click the link provided in the episode description or head over to Synth Music Mastering.
Yeah, that's easy to answer, because I sort of wanted to step away from the basic drum programming of Lost Summer, because it was I wouldn't say simple, but maybe more simplified, and I started gathering more ideas from maybe other genres, because I'm really a big French house fan, and I try to get loops and samples from that genre, and try to see how I could fit them into my new songs, and also there was just like an immediate connection I found between the sounds I found and the music and the sounds I was working on.
So you mentioned then about you didn't want to program the same drums. So how did you approach that differently?
Well, I sort of used more layering techniques. Like I Like, I layered the bass drums, I layered the snare sounds. I use more percussion loops because, you know, it's, I think that's to me, I'm not a really good drum programmer. So I tend to use percussion loops now, and I think they work really well for me. I tweaked them a little. I changed them. I cut them up, and I sort of make them swing in the way I want to. But I think that was the really big change from the first album.
Drum programming is a tricky one. I find that as well. I often find myself sort of resorting to finding loops, and then, as you say, sort of like manipulating them, time stretching, cutting them up, and then augmenting them with other samples. Because I know you get some people, and you've got trigger pads, and they're and triggering in these great drum beats and stuff, but or electronic drum kits. But I don't know. It's a skill that I could probably learn, but I don't know if I necessarily want to invest the time. Maybe I should. But no, I definitely follow a similar pattern. So what I want to sort of dive into more about is, can you tell our audience about the songwriting and composition of the third song, BMX Chase? So how did you start writing BMX Chase, and how did the composition come together?
Actually, BMX Chase was one of the first songs I wrote when I started producing music again. That was before last summer. I knew it was a good composition, but when I initially made it, I sort of felt like I didn't have the techniques maybe to make it into the song I wanted it to be, and I just kept working on it. And when I was doing the second album, I picked it up again, and I tried to use some of the techniques I had been using on some of the other songs, and it worked really well. And also the atmosphere and the chord structure maybe, and the melody also fit the theme of the other songs, and I just went from there, and that's how I got that together.
Cool. But my next question is then, so you mentioned there about techniques, that at the time you didn't have the techniques to sort of push the song to where you wanted it to go. Are you able to sort of disclose what those techniques were and how you sort of overcame that over time?
Yeah, sure. Well, maybe, as you know, I did a release stream for my second album. And I showed some of the songs templates in the live stream, and BMX Chase was one of them. So I have no problem disclosing that. I think the thing I learned the most is to kind of glue together drums and bass and the whole song, and make it sound organic. Maybe, if you know what I mean. And like I said, I was moving more towards samples from a more EDM orientated direction. All the things I learned while doing the other songs, like using more compression, using more sidechain, getting it to sound flowing, maybe that really helped me to finish that song.
That's cool. So it sort of reiterates, I guess, the mantra of, like, the more you do it, is sort of the more songs and the more songwriting you do, the more production you do, you progress and you learn. And then I think it's quite cool. I've done that myself, whereby I've written songs, produced them, and then gone back to older projects, knowing that I can make them better based on the experience I've had, which is a great thing to do.
Yeah, it's hard to kind of anticipate to what your listening audience is going to think of like your new style, and you know, I was really happy with how the album came together and how it was released. Like I said, the live stream I did, I was really, really happy with that, because last time I felt like, you know, I put so much time and effort into making this album, and then, you know, you just go to bed and then at midnight your songs go online and basically that's it. So I was really happy to do that and see the reaction from everyone. And it was a great live stream. But, you know, like I said, you don't really know how people are going to react to the new tracks. And, you know, I've been fortunate to have a few loyal listeners and, you know, people who I connected with. But I sort of have the feeling my second album was maybe less appreciated than the first. It's hard to put your finger on it.
Yeah, sorry. I think the connection cut out a bit there. But yeah, I think the live stream's a great idea to release a single. Is that something you'll do going forward then, do you think, with your next release? Will you do a live stream again?
Yeah, for sure. I think it's a great idea, and you know, we had Adrian from At 1980 as our guests, as my guest, and he also really liked the idea. Maybe he'll do it as well. So yeah, I think there is definitely something there to make it more into to make the release something you can enjoy yourself and connect with people.
Yeah, I think it's a great idea doing the live streams. I do like live streaming. I've taken on to doing live streams of some podcast interviews as well. Slightly different, but I think that interactivity is great. And I think the more you do it, the more of an audience you build up as well. And it's just that interaction. It's quite cool as well, I guess. Like when you do release it, like you say, you can set your song to be released at midnight on a given date. But actually being sort of awake and live streaming as it's released and getting that real-time feedback is really, really cool. Really cool. So I'll keep an eye out for the next one. So going back to the album, so how do you sort of go about piecing the track order together? Because that's always something I'm really interested in, because I've done albums in the past in different genres, and I always find it tricky to order an album. Where do you start? Where do you start when it comes to putting your tracks in order for an album?
I take a piece of paper and I start writing, sort of what I have in my mind. No, it really works like that. I just take a piece of paper and I just start putting arrows and changing the number, the song numbers, the song order, and that's how I work. I try to switch it up, do slow songs or ambient songs, and then maybe a little bit of a faster track, and try to change the pace of the album so you don't have like one part of the album very slow and the other part very fast. So that's basically how I approach it.
Oh, I like that. It's kind of like a juxtaposition, as we say, of the songs then. So slow, fast songs to slow an album down. You can control the tempo, I guess, of how the listener's listening to the album. So I always find it interesting to find out how people do it, because, it's, like I say, it's always something that I probably spend way too much time psychoanalyzing how it's going to sound, rather than just going with my gut. So what I'd like to talk about next is ask you a question on is actually having listened to the album is a bit about the sound design. So in a few of the tracks, you've got these really nice sort of like lush pad sounds. How do you create the pad sounds? How do you design those sounds? And sort of what VSTs or audio units are you using to create your pads?
Yeah, that's also something I addressed in the live stream. Basically, I think I said that last time. I'm using a lot of free virtual synthesizers. So the Synth One, I think I mentioned that as well. The Synth One has a really warm, nice sound that I like. And for the last album, I use a lot of the PGA8X synthesizer, which has the Roland 80 sound. And those two are really my go-to synthesizers to get the pad and the chord sounds and the sounds for the patches for the main melodies. And really, in synthwave, you know, it's not complicated. Most patches are pretty simple. What I did do is put a little more detune. Like I was using Isotope Vinyl to sort of get a pitch warp on the sound. Yeah, which I think sort of made the sound as it is. And that's really specific, so I really liked how that sounded, and that's in a nutshell, that's how I approached that.
Yeah, I remember you saying now about using the free software synths, and I've done a few interviews now for series two, whereby a lot of artists now are sort of saying that the freeware, as it were, software synths are brilliant. And I need to do more investigating into them myself, because from what I can see, there's some fantastic ones out there. My next question, going off on a slight tangent here, is you mentioned there about creating pad sounds are quite quite relatively easy to find. What do you think is the hardest sound to create in sort of like the synthwave soundscape? What do you think is the hardest sound?
Yeah, I always struggle with the more FM bell sounds, because, you know, of course, frequency modulation sounds are, you know, very hard to make, and I really have no idea how to make a patch with frequency modulation. So I have a lot of experience with subtractive synthesis, but. You know, FM sounds are really not my cup of tea. I always worked with, you know, the Moogs and the Rolands, and, you know, the stuff I had when I started making music, and that's why probably I go back to those, because I remember them from when I had the actual hardware synths, because, you know, I know how they are rooted and where the buttons are and the sliders are, so I kind of go back to those more simpler synthesis roots.
Yeah, I think I'm probably with you there. Subtractive synthesis is certainly, and additive synthesis, certainly easier forms of synthesis than FM, because the DX7, if I remember rightly, is an FM synthesizer, FM synthesis. I think years ago I used to noodle around with Reactor, and I tried to create an FM synth in Reactor. Can't remember if I did or not, but it is a lot. There are so many macros involved with FM synthesis, and you can just get lost down a rabbit hole. But subtractive synthesis certainly is probably my go-to one as well. It's probably the one I go to straight away, really, when it comes to sound design. But that's cool. Thanks for sharing that. Another song I want to sort of like have a bit of a chat to you about is Young Hearts. Can you tell our audience about how this song came together and sort of like the composition behind that? So that's Young Hearts.
We'll be right back. If you love good music and good podcasts, you'll love Roots Music Rambler. I'm Jason Falls. My co-host Francesca Folinazzo and I talk to the singers, songwriters, musicians, and more in Americana, alt-country, bluegrass, folk, blues, and beyond. We share our own takes on the latest news in the space and recommend new music for you to explore every episode. Come get to the roots of the music you love. Find us at rootsmusicrambler.com or go wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe to Roots Music Rambler.
Yeah, that was the first melody I composed for the new album, and I think it sort of shaped the rest of my ideas for the album. I just started playing my keyboard, and that's how I usually compose my songs. I just take the patch from Synth 1 I always use, and I just start playing. I just found the melody straight away, but it took me a long time to evolve into a song, because at that time I didn't have the drum sounds I came to use later. So I revisited that song at the end of the process of writing the album. And I just found a few new melody lines and I got the song. After that, I finished it, you know, within a few hours.
A few hours? Oh, fair play, man. I often find it takes me ages to finish songs. That's great. Which kind of leads me on to another question now, actually. So when it comes to writing your music, do you set yourself deadlines? I always ask this question because I'm intrigued to know how people, if they're like me and they just keep editing and mixing, or do you think, right, you know what? At the end of Tuesday, the end of today, whatever, Sunday today, but Tuesday, I'm going to have this song finished and then I'm going to move on. Do you set yourself sort of hard deadlines, or do you just, it's finished when it's finished?
Yeah, I know now after 25 years of making music that if I can't finish a song in 1 or 2 days, you know, I'm not ever going to be able to do it, you know. Yeah, I just know it. So whenever I have a really good idea, you know, the songwriting just starts flowing. I always tell my wife, it's coming. I feel it coming. And I just start and I know I'll finish it. You know, it's just something you can feel, I guess. Because, you know, in an album, there are only 8 to maybe 12 songs. And you know, that's if you work 1 year on the album, that's one song every month. So, you know, it's something special. I feel it's something special, and I can just feel it. So, yeah, it's more of a gut feeling, and I'm never wrong. So, I feel I'm never wrong about that. And maybe the good thing. I signed with Outland Recordings for two albums, and basically the albums had to be done within the time frame that was in the contract. And looking back, I think that helped me to focus and you know, not overly try to worry about details and change a whole lot of things. So I think that was useful for me to have that deadline.
Yeah, I agree. I think working to deadlines is good because, as you say, it does focus you. And I really like your conviction then of when you say you're never wrong. That's great. That's a great line to take away from the podcast. I like that. I love it. I think deadlines are great to focus you. And it's something I need to instill more of. So for the audience listening, deadlines, if you're struggling to finish a track, look at your time management. So moving on next is, I just want to say congratulations. So I checked out on Bandcamp on Selling Out 80s Dreams and Lost Summer. So you have a CD bundle. I have a question off the back of that, which is why, was there any particular reason why you opted to release the album on CD and cassette?
Yeah, that's a label decision. You know, of course we go back and forth about it. But I think originally Outland was mainly releasing cassettes because CDs were less selling. But as interest in synthwave started growing, I think we saw different formats getting more attention, like minidisc and CD. Seeing the success of Lost Summer on CD as well, we decided to release it on cassette and CD at the same time.
Ah, cool. So I guess it was a historic sort of label decision then. It's intriguing to see the success of cassettes. And I see many, many artists now releasing on cassette, which is great. And once again, it's probably something I'd like to look into myself. I've got an old tape deck that I need to fix, and it's great. I think I'd like to start collecting cassettes. CDs, less so. I recently started collecting vinyl, going back to the story right at the beginning of the episode, but I've only got about two so far.
Yeah, I have a, I wouldn't recommend having a large vinyl collection, because I have one. You know, it's such a large volume to keep, and you know it's nice to collect vinyl, but it's just it takes up a lot of space.
Do you ever listen to them?
No, I don't anymore. Actually, they're somewhere in my brother's basement or something. I don't know. I don't know where they are. They are somewhere.
I have that. I have boxes in my attic space, my loft space, full of just random bits of audio equipment and like CDs. I think there's probably maybe some DVDs in there as well. I thought I got rid of all those, but I probably still have them somewhere. Let's take a quick break from this episode so that I can tell you about a free resource that I made for you. It's a PDF checklist that describes what you need to do to properly prepare a mix for mastering. So you've done the hard work and you love your mix, yet suitably preparing a mix for mastering is often overlooked by musicians, resulting in delayed sessions, excessive back and forth conversation, and frustration on both parts. I want to help fix that. So if you want this free resource, just go to www.synthmusicmastering.com, as this checklist will help and guide you to make the mastering process as smooth, transparent, and exciting as possible. So again, the URL is www.synthmusicmastering.com for this free preparing a mix for mastering checklist. Let's get back to the episode. My next question is kind of moving on from away from the album, and this is more to do with sort of like being a recording artist. So there's a couple of questions, and the first one is I just like to get, so it's been over a year since we've had a chat. So how do you feel about being a recording artist in the current music business? How has that sort of changed, if it has, over the last 12 months?
It's a good question, and probably the answer is not so easy to give, because I'm really happy with how my music has been received, and if you were a producer 20 years ago, you know, this would be a dream, you know, because basically if you didn't have a label, I mean a label, like not a label like you know them now, just doing streams, just uploading to platforms, I mean a real label, if you don't have a real label, your music wasn't going to be listened by anyone. So in that retrospect, you know, the way synthwave community is, you know, it's great. You know, you have people listening to your music. You have a lot of support. So for that, I'm really grateful and happy. But at the same time, I feel like, you know, there's a lot of talk, like we discussed last time, that synthwave is dead, and then you had some talk about people copying other artists, and that, you know, the genre is very limiting, and you know, fresh, you know, maybe we are running out of fresh ideas, which I don't agree with, but that was one part of the discussion. And you know, I think my main concern as a producer now is that, you know, our social media platforms or channels are being flooded by the same people all the time, and there are really no breakthrough artists who started, you know, within the last, I think, 2 to 3 years, there hasn't been a there hasn't been a really breakthrough artist like you know you had in the beginning of synthwave, the first 5 years maybe. And I think, you know, it's just very saturated, and it's really hard to get through the static, and that's probably my biggest frustration, that you know, always the same acts are being promoted and being pushed, And you know, other beginning artists don't really get that platform.
No, it's really interesting. I think I've had the same similar conversations with other artists as well, notably about the static or noise, as you would call it. When there's so much being released, being able to stand out through that static, through that noise, is tricky. And especially when you say the same artists are being promoted and pushed. Can you think of any way that could change? What could we do to shake up the genre for that to change, do you think?
Well, I think it's hard to solve, because I think the listeners from the main acts really are not interested to listen to anything else. So how do you solve it? You know, it's very hard. I think probably. I think it would be a great idea if the bigger names would maybe get involved into pushing some of the more underground artists. You know, they don't have a responsibility to do it, but you know, it would probably be nice. And I think also something that keeps us all going is people who like your work. If you like someone's work, you know, share it. I think that's probably the biggest way to change it. And I think people underestimate their potential to help other people. And that's something I always try to do. If I'm really passionate or excited about a particular song or band, I always try to share it. So I think that's a good way to start.
Yeah, I agree. And I think, I don't know if it was yourself, maybe we chatted about this last time, or it might have been on another interview, about the big names pushing artists. And it would be great if you did see that, because I remember having this conversation, and it is something that you just don't see enough of. And it, like you say, I guess they're not obligated to do it, but I think it would certainly help if every so often you just saw a really big name actually just pushing like a breakthrough artist, an artist who's come out with a great song that deserves that wider audience, which would be great to see, as you say. I've got a quick question about what you mentioned earlier about ideas, because you said about, I think right at the beginning when I asked you the first question, you mentioned about how synthwave, you're hearing, some would say that it's potentially running out of ideas, but you said it's not. Why do you think it's not running out of ideas?
Yeah, because, you know, everyone is different. And I know people are saying, you know, the influx from new producers is bad and it's watering out synthwave. I think it's the opposite. You get new fresh views on synthwave. You know, I have a different background than you, and another producer has a completely different musical background than you. And so we can keep going. And in my particular case, you know, I'm influenced a lot by French house and hip hop, and you know, it's not like I'm trying to copy the main acts of synthwave. I try to do what I like to listen to outside of synthwave and infuse that into my sound, and create what I have in my mind, what I like to listen to. So, you know, no, I don't think synthwave, you know, pop music is not dead. You know, techno is not dead. Synthwave will always, I think, have its place in the musical tree.
Yeah, I remember us having this conversation last time about that, say, because I remember you saying that synthwave will never die. And that was going to be my sort of next question was, do you still follow that ideology? And I think, judging by what you said then, that you do, that synthwave will never die. And I think it's for that reason that you said there about artists coming from all of these different genres and bringing in their own influences. And I think that's key. I think that's key for most musical genres, really, to keep it fresh and exciting, is to experiment and bring in different elements from different genres and different influences. And I hear it all the time. I think when I'm listening to new artists, when I'm digging around on Bandcamp or in Spotify or somewhere around there. And then, yeah, so to echo what you said then, I totally agree. And I think off the back of that conversation, I think the big thing is going back to what you said earlier about about sharing and sharing. If you like a song, if you like what an artist has done, it's just share it. Doesn't take much to like to share a song from Spotify on an Instagram story or on Twitter, etc. You know. So whilst touching on social media, then I think if I remember rightly, we had a conversation about social media, and I think that you weren't the biggest fan. Do you find yourself using social media more now, or are you still trying to not use it as sort of like too much, as it were?
Yeah, I'm not really a fan of social media, and before last summer I didn't have any social media accounts. I just had my SoundCloud, and to be honest, my view really hasn't changed. But what's nice about the social media channels is to discover other artists. But you know, as a means of promoting myself, I really loathe it, and I really don't like to do it. But you know, at the same time, I try to be myself and try to be real and authentic when I communicate, and not overly push myself onto people. And that's really how I approach it now. I've been taking it a little bit easier now as well, because I felt I needed that time to step back and do some other things and spend some more time with my family. And I've also sort of neglected my day job a little, so I needed to catch up on that. And I think social media is really low on my priority list.
It is a time suck, isn't it? Social media, you can just get lost in it. And I very much agree with you. I mean, I use it as much as possible for promotional purposes, but I try and dedicate if I'm going to use it, like a period of time a day, and then I stick to it. And I just don't want to get in that habit of just scrolling through social media. Now it's total time suck, and like you say, you can find yourself neglecting other important activities.
I even deleted all the social media from my phone, so I only have access to them from my music desktop, which really allows me to focus on what I need to do, and like you say, not use it as a distraction, because maybe I'm an old-fashioned guy, but seeing people scroll through their phones when they're with their family, I think that's horrible. And maybe people don't realize it now, but the way they are neglecting their families and friends, it's taken a toll on society in general. And you have to also be careful with I think the youth, because that's what they're used to now. And you obviously notice that in society things are changing, and people are getting more frustrated, and their general attitude is not really really great, probably.
Yeah, and it's interesting, I find, specifically because I've delved into this, the algorithms of these social media platforms and the way they are designed just to keep you on their platform and scrolling by throwing content at you that the algorithm has decided that you're interested in based on your previous search and scrolling history, which is quite a scary thought, really, when something's designed to grab your attention and just have you sort of mindlessly, might be the wrong word, but just scrolling, you know? And it's designed just to keep you on its platform and keep you engaged and absorbing and consuming this content, which ultimately doesn't really fuel any purpose other than sort of the coffers of possibly Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook and Instagram.
I think the same thing probably happened with TV, because I also don't watch TV. I haven't watched TV probably in 30 years or something, or 25 years. It just makes people brain dead, and it's just the same thing, but worse, even worse. And like you said, if you think for yourself, you can just see it's not healthy what what these companies are doing, and you are the product. So why on earth would you want to be a product?
Yeah, exactly. I totally agree. And it's quite a nice segue that we've come up with there, which is health. And what I want to move on to next is I remember at the end of last episode afterwards, we spoke about being plant-based and veganism. And we said that next time we have a chat, we'll have a quick chat about being vegan. So for the audience listening, I haven't mentioned this yet, but I'm a vegan myself, and I am 3 years, I think it is now. How long have you been vegan?
I think it's been a year now that we're fully vegan. But we're not just vegan, we're whole food plant-based vegans. Non-gluten organic. So it's quite complicated to get our stuff. But we've been sort of flexitarians for a long time, my wife and I, and even before that, I was not really into eating meat. But we saw a documentary on Netflix about how they were treating animals, and you know, we from that day on, we just threw away everything we had in our fridge and in our cupboards, and we dove into, you know, what veganism is. And well, it turns out to be not what society is telling you what it is, because, you know, in school you are learning about the food pyramid, but that's just rubbish, you know, that point of view, because when man in history, it was impossible to get a lot of meat, so we are plant eaters. We've always been plant eaters, and we were never meant to consume meat or dairy. You know, we are not. You know, if you look at our teeth, we are plant eaters. You know, people who are saying we have teeth to eat meat. You try, my friend, to shoot an animal and eat it with your teeth. I wish you a lot of luck.
Yeah. I agree. And you it's exactly right, isn't it? Because I always say this, because I went down the similar route, which was I was eating meat, and then I went sort of vegetarian when I was just I stopped eating, probably actually pescatarian, so I was eating fish. And then I was like, well, I think I probably watched the same documentary. I watched one called Cow Conspiracy, if I remember rightly, on Netflix. And there was another one I watched as well on Netflix. And then I thought to myself, you know what? And then I saw the health benefits as well. Yeah. And I thought, I'll give this a go. And then, but going back to what you said there about shooting and then eating it with your teeth, it's not going to happen. It's, I have the same discussion with a lot of people when they talk about milk and dairy. And I always say to them, it's like milk from a cow is designed to get a calf and turn it into a one ton cow. As quickly as possible. It's not designed for us as humans to consume.
You should ask them, are you going to drink milk from your cow, from your cat, or from your dog? Are you going to drink milk from a monkey? You know, why? It's just the same. Like you say, it's designed to breed a calf and to make it as big and strong in a short period of time. So everything that's in there is designed to do that. So why as a human being would you drink that? And you know, it's funny that we got into veganism in a similar way. And actually, I think like I mentioned TV earlier, that they are basically brainwashing people to you know, with the news, and it's always the same. And they are trying to push political agendas, and certain lobbies are very strong, like the supermarket lobbies. If you look at a supermarket, basically it's the most unhealthy place on the planet. And you know, those lobbies of dairy and meat are very, very strong. And I think probably companies like Netflix, you know, they are of course multinational companies, but at the same time, the information you are able to get from them is more objective than anything you can see on TV.
I would agree. It's very interesting. And there's a lot of material out there now with regards to that, and sort of backing up what you're saying there. I mean, I've done it for 3 years now, and I do feel better in myself for having done it. And not that I'd want to, but I would struggle to go back. It's so sort of entrenched in me in terms of routine as well now, and habit, the way I shop and the way I eat and the way I just live my life daily. Do you feel any different having done it? Like, do you feel the health benefits?
Yeah, for sure. I don't get any more afternoon dips. Which was probably caused by gluten and probably the processed foods. So we try to avoid processed foods altogether. That's why I'm saying we're whole food, organic, vegans. I was already before that very conscious about animal pain and animal suffering, and it's probably I'm probably even more sensitive now about the topic, because you know it hurts me to see how society is arranged to hurt. To exploit animals, and I don't think we have a right to do it, because they are also beings, that natural beings, and it really hurts me to see, and I don't blame people, you know, I'm not going to attack anyone eating meat, you know, most people don't have an informed standpoint on it, because they just don't know better. They think they're doing the right thing, because on TV they tell you it's healthy to eat meat, to get your iron, to get your vitamin B, and you know it's just not true. That's probably very frustrating, and why it's good, I think, to talk about it, and why I occasionally post about it on my social media to get more people informed on it. Because, you know, I've said this to other people. They say, you know, aren't you missing vitamins, and aren't you missing? But look at what you're eating. You're eating the same thing all the time. You're eating meat and potatoes. And, you know, where is your variation in your food? You're eating white bread. You're eating white rice. You're eating white pasta all the time. So where is your variation? You know, you're the one who should be getting checked up on.
Yeah, I often hear that as well. I remember when I told my family that I was doing it, and the first thing they said was like, I think the exact words were something along the lines of, why, what's wrong? And I was like, well, nothing's wrong with me. But then there was the question of, what about protein? What about your vitamins and stuff? And I was like, it's like you say, isn't it? I think as a society, we've just been told, oh, to get your iron, to get your calcium, drink milk.
And I think the media and schools and education, there is an influence behind that is making fun of veganism or painting out to be something extremist by purpose, because you know the less people that know the truth, you know, the more they can sell. And you know, like I said, the food pyramid. Why is it still in school books? Why are we still using it? You know, dairy should be scrapped. Meat should be scrapped. That's crazy that they are still teaching children they need to eat meat.
No, it's great to have this chat with you, Ewan, because I remember like I said last time, we said we were going to discuss it, and I think it's the first time on the podcast I've ever had a discussion about nutrition, which is great. I'm all for diversifying the podcast, and that's brilliant. Thank you. Thanks for sharing your thoughts on that. It's really interesting to hear that you followed a very similar pathway to my own, albeit not the gluten aspect. So I realize we're coming up to an hour now. So what I'd like to do is just wrap things up nicely. So, Herman, where can our audience find you online? Where can they find the Future Kids online?
Well, I think primarily I'm on Twitter a lot because I feel it's the most direct way to keep in touch with people. And of course, my music, you can find my music on Bandcamp and all the streaming platforms. But I myself, I'm a big Bandcamp user, so I generally refer people to Bandcamp. That's where you can find me.
Ace, and as like last time, for the audience listening, I'll put all those links in the show notes as well. Herman, big thank you again for spending the time with me today. It's great to put your brains on, well, to hear about the exciting gig that's coming up, and also put your brains on the story behind your latest release, 80s Dreams. And once again, I'll put a link to that. The Bandcamp link to that in the show notes, and also just to talk about the recording industry and veganism as well. So yeah, big thank you for joining me today. It's great chat.
Yeah, thank you, Mark, for having me. Yeah, it's been great. Yeah, thanks for picking my brain.
Yeah, I'm thinking I've been saying that now to people for the past it's episode 31. I probably need to come up with a different phrase at the end. There you go. That's the deeper thought. Anyway, I'll speak to you soon, Herman.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to our show. If you like what you're hearing, make sure to rate our show on Apple Podcasts. Whoa! Before you go, make sure to snag your free test master from Synth Music Mastering. Imagine enhancing your music with my steadfast dedication to quality and that personalized touch. And here's the kicker, it's absolutely free. No cost at all. Simply head over to synthmusicmastering.com or click the link in the episode description to claim your free test master.